I'm Brooke Gladstone with this week's On the Media Podcast Extra. So there's comedy and there's news, and there's that amalgamation of the two called satire or lampoonery, or in the parlance of Jon Stewart, fake news. How do you make it? Especially if you began in journalism. If you watch The Daily Show, The Nightly Show, or Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, you might like to know. And here's your chance to find out. Last month, I moderated a discussion among writers and producers from those shows, convened by the News School in New York City. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't thinking about radio. Big oversight. So I didn't identify them every time they spoke. So I'll tell you who they are now. Representing The Daily Show with Trevor Noah are Daniel Radosh, longtime journalist and blogger who's contributed to just about everything, including The New York Times, Esquire, Slate, and The New Yorker, and Dan Imyra, who came from a long stint at New York Magazine. For The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore, writer Cord Jefferson, who's actually just left the show to become a writer on Aziz Ansari's Master of None. Before his gig with Wilmore, he had, among other things, served as the West Coast editor of Gawker. Representing Full Frontal are producers Sonia Dosani and Noreen Khan, both of whom came directly from Al Jazeera America. So let's go. Let me first ask, Daniel Radosh, what was the biggest transition from print to television?
I think the hardest thing was figuring out what to do with all of the money.
Okay, so there are two places we're going to go. First of all, how your jobs as journalists prepared you for what you're doing now. And then secondly, how do you do what you're doing now, and what happens when it goes catastrophically wrong? Cord, can I begin with you?
Sure.
I mean, what do you think you were able to bring to the show, and how weird was it to be called?
I had worked in television for one season on a different sitcom before starting a Nightly Show. I always wanted to be a writer. I never sort of set out to be a journalist. My literary idols were like Joan Didion and James Baldwin and these people who would go from writing a novel to like following a political campaign to writing a play. What it meant for them to be writers was like very broad. So for me, the opportunity to transition from journalism into television was just an opportunity to sort of do what I was already doing, but sort of develop some new muscle memory in doing that. A new adventure as opposed to just a brand new career, because it kind of is. If you're doing journalism and you're good at it and you know how to tell a story and you know how to craft a narrative from point A to point B and bring a reader or a viewer on that path with you, you can do that with television too.
So not journalism, but these are topical programs. So Can you remember the first skit you wrote for The Nightly Show?
God.
Or any skit.
Something that I pitched and pitched and pitched and pitched, and people shot it down over and over and over again, but I finally got it on. I pitched a conversation with a radical Muslim. But he was like a radical Muslim, like he surfed, like a skateboarding radical Muslim. So that's one that I pitched like six times, and every time it got shot down. But then it was like the stars aligned perfectly one day, and I had a really great sort of like comedic take on it, and we went from there.
And preparation?
Just what Cord said about knowing how to tell a story is definitely true. I mean, when I started at The Daily Show, it was 6 years ago. It was pretty well established, and Jon really knew what he was doing, and he had intentionally assembled a writing staff with people with a lot of different backgrounds. So there were pure joke writers, people who had done stand-up or sketch comedy, as well as people who had been journalists. I had only really ever been a journalist. I had done humorous journalism, but I thought of myself as a journalist and didn't really have any interest in writing for television. And in fact, when I went in for an interview with The Daily Show, you know, they said, why do you want to leave journalism? And it was 2009, so it was a good time to leave print journalism. I didn't say that, though. What I said was that, and this is mostly true, that I don't want to write for television. I want to write for this show. Because The Daily Show was doing something that I understood as a journalist, but also was not really journalism. It was about being funny. Yeah, you bring that sort of same sensibility and that adherence to the facts. It's just a matter of kind of what your end goal is.
Mm-hmm. New York Magazine.
Yeah.
Now, you were writing funny there.
Yeah. I was writing about news, politics, current events for a blog called Daily Intel at New York Magazine. And the transition to The Daily Show was actually kind of seamless because the challenge for both of them is the same, which is when you're blogging about the news for a website, you're trying to make your take, your angle, whatever, stand out from all the other websites that are writing about the same news that same day. And when you're writing for The Daily Show, you're trying to make your angle stand out from the 40 other late night shows that are covering the same news that day. So do I have an interesting thing to say about this? Do I have an interesting way to present this? Do I have a case to make that no one's thought of before? And so you were just writing for print, and then you move it to TV. It wasn't really that different.
What was your skit?
The first
Tell me
one?
If you can remember.
Honestly, I don't remember like what we did earlier this week.
Dan has sort of carved out a little niche for himself, developed something that we now call the Trump Archives, where he has dug into
Trump's sordid past.
Trump's sordid past, and I know you seem like you would think, well, that's all out there, but Dan has managed to find some stuff that hadn't been out there until he found it.
Yeah.
Donald Trump sort of speculating on the size of his one-year-old daughter's breasts, for example. Mm-hmm. So that's journalism.
Yeah.
Sonia, you're a segment producer.
Mm-hmm.
How different was working for Full Frontal from Al Jazeera, and how did those skills transfer?
Actually, my job is almost exactly the same as it was at Al Jazeera. I guess the biggest difference has been the kinds of stories that we cover. At Al Jazeera, there's not really a lot of room for humor in our in our newsrooms. We like to call ourselves the broccoli of news, so you can't do that. This is like the chocolate of news. So it's a lot of digging through the archives, and instead of finding the most depressing soundbites, I now find the most hilarious and depressing soundbites. So.
Noreen, you were doing digital work at Al Jazeera and at Full Frontal?
It's basically the same kind of work that I was doing as I was a digital reporter for Al Jazeera, the only digital reporter in the DC bureau. So I was covering all politics, and I'd kind of gotten burnt out on basically what I felt like was writing the same story over and over and over and over and over again. But at Full Frontal, I think I do all of the reporting, but I don't have to write it, which is kind of nice. Since we're a weekly show, I get to dig pretty deeply into topics and then present it to the producers and writers and say, you know, this is what I think is important. Like, please write a joke off of this and make people care about it.
What are your priorities? How do you decide which subjects to skewer?
We're looking for fun stuff, but I know me and Sonia tend to pitch the most depressing stories at Full Frontal.
It's the Al Jazeera in us.
Yeah. No, that's definitely true. And it feels great to be at a place where I feel like we have the infrastructure to take something really depressing and present it to the masses, and that's kind of what really attracted me to the job.
She is really a master at that, at presenting the horrendous in a funny way, and it's going well. And so, do you want to talk at all, Sonia, about priorities, how you come up with ideas? Do the writers just say, no, we can't make that funny?
I think the good thing about our show is that everyone is really interested in tackling those hard topics. Things like Syrian refugees and Guantanamo Bay and really tough issues like that that you don't even see in regular news a lot of times. People want to do stories that make them have like a visceral reaction. As long as that's there, I think nobody is going to close the door on a story unless, you know, just like if the facts aren't there, or if the elements aren't there, if there's no video to support it. Those are things that would disqualify something, but I don't think that we ever shy away from, oh, it's too serious or it's too depressing. I think that's like a challenge. Like, how can we take this and make it something funny?
Can you tell me something that got killed?
I think Noreen is our designated story killer, so.
Yeah, sometimes the facts aren't there, but I can't really think of like a prominent one that we've killed. The Guantanamo one, we thought about it for a really long time before it actually got going, and it seemed like it was on the cusp of death.
Previous versions of it died a lot of times, but it kept coming back.
The Daily Show carved out this area, you know, way back when. How do you decide on a topic? And then what's the process?
Writers will pitch stories about what interests them. I mean, a lot of times it is just, there's something in the news, we want to talk about it. That's not the best kind of story. That happens a lot because we want to do that. But the best kind of story is one that somebody's noticed a trend or a story that other people haven't picked up on, or just had an idea about a type of thing they want to do and then gathered enough separate stories that it makes sense.
Do you have an example?
Well, no. where I was kind of going with it is that Trevor likes to say that we're not doing a fake news show. We're doing a comedy show about the news. And so he wants stories that, as he often puts it, are the kind of thing that are interesting enough that you would tell a friend in a bar. And then what's the funny way of telling that friend that story, as opposed to something that we can report out the way that journalists would.
Is that a change from how it was before Trevor?
A little bit, yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't want to say that we were doing real journalism under John either. It was a comedy show too, but it was more of comedy in the form of news, I think, under John, with a lot of exceptions. But that said, once you start telling that story, in order for it to be as funny as possible, it has to be as true as possible. And if you want to inform people, you have to get the story right. So there are a lot of similar elements, including fact-checking. We have a researcher and a team of producers who make sure that all the stuff that we're saying is right, and sometimes they will say, this isn't right, and we try not to let that kill the story. What we try to do is think and say, okay, well, what's the right way to say that? Or if we're totally wrong, why did we think we were right, and how can we use that to tell a different story?
Can you give me an example of a story that went wrong?
Well, so this is an interesting thing because we do fact-checking, right? Anything that is a fact gets checked to make sure that it is true. But in a news show, you really have to build all the facts from the ground up. In the comedy show, you build the story and then check to make sure that it works out. So, for instance, a few years ago, John did a piece about how Mississippi finally got around to ratifying the 13th Amendment, repealing slavery. That, in fact, it was supposed to have happened a few years earlier, and the attorney general, I forget what his title was, but some state official, was supposed to have filed the paperwork, and it just got lost. And so John did a joke where he said, and the official's name was Dick Mulpus of Mississippi. And here's my impression of Dick Mulpus filing that paperwork and then putting it into a shredder. Which is a funny joke because it's Mississippi and slavery and a guy named Dick Mulpus. And it's also, it's clearly a joke, so the fact checker didn't like, well, did he really shred it? Like, no, you wouldn't check that thing because it's a joke. Except that the next day we began hearing from viewers in Mississippi saying, Dick Mulpus is one of the most progressive civil rights leaders in the state. And the only thing that the poor guy had done wrong was be from Mississippi and named Dick Mulpus. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. And John apologized to him on air. It actually was great. We got a whole other segment out of it.
How much responsibility does the show have to be perfectly accurate? Just enough to not get calls from Mississippi?
No, I mean, we want everything to be perfectly accurate, especially because we're The Daily Show and we're the ones, like, nitpicking everyone else's shit. So if we're the ones doing that to other people, it's pretty embarrassing to have our own mistakes that people call us on. So we have to be, like, extra, extra careful. And we are. We're super careful. I would imagine more careful than probably some, like, straight-up news places because it's more embarrassing for us to make that mistake.
I will say, as an example of the care that we put into this, our chief researcher, a guy named Adam Chodakoff, when he checks facts, a lot of times when I was a freelancer and the magazine wanted to check a fact, they would look in the New York Times and see if it had been reported there, and that was good enough for them. And Adam Chodakoff will say, the New York Times does not check facts. They rely on reporters to get it right, and usually reporters do get it right, but sometimes they don't. He will always try to go to the source rather than to a second hand.
Court, you began by saying that it wasn't your goal to be a journalist, but to be a writer. And I'm just wondering, do you think that writing off the news
fosters humor or inhibits it?
I would say that writing off of the news fosters humor. At least it did with me, because you have something new to write about every single day. If you're following the news, you cast a wide net because you have a bunch of different stuff to talk about. So I'm sort of a gross combination of a perfectionist and a procrastinator. So if I have my druthers, I won't work on anything and I'll just sit around forever until it's due the night before. So whereas
medicate with adrenaline.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas working on The Nightly Show, every single day you have to come in and look at what's going on and come up with something funny about it. You have to do that every single day of your life, and that's your career. I mean, especially now. I mean, do we need like a better example that the news is funny than the past 6 months, this past election cycle? Like, if those are your targets, it's very clear that there's going to be something ripe for humor every single day.
Although some people say that the situation is so absurd that it makes fun of itself and it almost preempts humor.
Mm-hmm. How can you be any funnier than Donald Trump is already? Like, you can't. Sometimes you just want to play his speeches, and that's going to be the show. I think that at The Nightly Show, we felt it was our job, though, then not just to show the news, but then to give a deeper layer to just the one-off joke. I was thinking, actually, about your earlier question about sort of where journalism actually came into play. And one of the earliest things that I can remember writing now, I don't know if everybody remembers the McKinney pool party. Does everybody remember that story where the cop beat up that girl in a bikini? And the video footage was insane, right? That's like the first layer of the story, right? And that's absurd on its face, and so you can have a lot of fun making fun of this psychopath cop, like beating up this girl in a bikini. As tragic as it is, that, you know, you can, there's like obvious humor there. maybe it's just like a sick comedy writer of mine, but I think there's obvious humor there. But one of the first things that I can remember writing for the show that I was actually proud of is that in the edit meeting, I remember us pitching out stories, and I pitched out an addendum to that story, which is that there's like a long history of white people segregating swimming pools and like white panic about black people swimming in their swimming pools. That is something that goes back to the civil rights movement. I found a photo actually accompanying the story where there was a white hotel owner dumping acid into his pool because there were black people swimming in the pool as a civil rights protest. And he walked up to the pool and was dumping this giant jug of acid in it, right? So this is something that happened in the 50s.
So you see why it's getting funny.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's like a horrifying thing, but that is something that we tried to do at the show. I'm no longer there, but that's something we try to do, is show the obvious funny part, but then add the extra layer of this is why this is culturally and historically important. For me, when the show really sang and when we were really hitting all cylinders, that's what we were doing, instead of just like, look at these jackasses on Fox News.
Did you leave recently?
I did. I write on a show called Master of None now. I'm writing on season 2.
Fans!
I left 5 weeks ago.
On the Nightly Show, there seemed to be for a while a nightly Bill Cosby segment.
Yeah.
Of just pure outrage.
There was. A, because it's so absurd, and B, because that was like very personally relevant to Larry. Larry was a black comedian who came up, not idolizing Bill Cosby, but, you know, Bill Cosby is, to this day, one of the most important comedians in American history. And so Larry saw that as like somebody who had failed him and had failed comedy in general and failed a lot of people. And so that really resonated with him deeply. So I think that, as I'm sure everybody over here will say, getting the host to respond to something is very, very important if you're going to make good work. And so when you actually find something that really, really makes them sit up in their chair a little bit, that's going to be great.
It felt very personal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting back to the journalism part again, I think that we've established that it doesn't matter how dark or tragic a story is, although maybe you need a little bit of time in some cases. But I wonder if there are certain stories that you just sort of leave them off the table because experience teaches you that this isn't going to work.
We can do dark stories, but we need footage that's not super dark.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, when we first tackled the Flint water crisis, we had the idea before it really became a big story, but a lot of the footage and the reports were about really tragic things. And it was important, and we all knew it was important, but we're a comedy show. Our job is not to tell the most important news, and there weren't enough clips that we could use that the audience wouldn't hear and go, like, I don't want to laugh at that. So the story itself wasn't too dark, because like you were saying, there's always humor to come out of dark material. But at least for us and for Trevor, the soundbite that we play to present this material can't be so off-putting that people shrink up into themselves.
Do you remember what the soundbite was you could finally use?
Well, I think eventually it becomes like a political story of like, who messed up, how did it get to this point, rather than just to hear some sick kid. So you have different targets to go at and things
so,
like that.
So neglect or cravenness or venality, that's a great angle into almost any story.
Right, you want, or at least the way Trevor likes to do it, you want a person that you can look at and either identify with or become the villain of the story. Again, if you're a journalist, well, that doesn't matter. If it's an abstract story, it's an abstract story, and you tell that. But if you're a comedian, abstract doesn't work as well, so you find the way to make it about someone, or you wait until it becomes about someone.
Because I just keep thinking of, you know, just that whole year where it was Michael Brown, Sandra Bland, Tamir Rice, and this is the weird role that these programs have, is they're kind of the viewer surrogate in the way. It's like the primal scream. I remember when a lot of people felt when The Daily Show was pretty much alone that it was the only thing that made them feel that they weren't crazy. And all of your shows do that to a certain extent, which I would think might put some additional pressure to deal with these issues that are so horrendous and emotional and worthy of primally screaming for the audience, even if it's laughter, but how? I just throw that out there, or I can put someone on the spot. Cord? You're closest. You're closest. Do you agree with that thesis, that it isn't just about laughter, that it's about acknowledgement? Do you know what I mean?
One of the problems that we had on our show, well, not a problem, but when we'd be discussing things, it often wasn't, is this too sad? It would be, is this too happy? Are we saying nothing? One of the stupidest things that I laughed at when I was a kid, but I thought it was so funny, and I still think about it, was, this will sort of age me, but I remember watching Dana Carvey on Saturday Night Live, and he did this skit called Massive Head Wound Harry, just with, it's exactly what it sounds like. He had makeup where he has a massive bleeding head wound, and he goes to like a cocktail party, and he's that guy. And so everywhere he goes, he's just trying to go through his day and like live his life. And everybody's like terrified of this massive head wound. And there was one extra funny one where a dog comes up and starts licking it, but then the dog starts pulling, the dog is a real dog and starts pulling off the head. And so Dana Carvey's like struggling to keep the prosthetic on. It was hilarious to me. I saw it when I was 9 years old, I thought it was brilliant. I say all that to say that like, as funny as I thought that was, I would never be able to pitch that for the shows that we make, ever. Mm-hmm. Because it's saying nothing, right? Like it's just pointless. As opposed to what we try to do every night, which is make something funny, but also make something that's relevant and timely and that you're saying something. We're not writing only comedy shows. We're writing something that's different from Saturday Night Live, and we're doing something that's different from other sketch comedy shows. So we need to keep that in mind. So oftentimes in our meetings, it wouldn't be like, is this too sad? Because we have capable people there who can make most everything funny. It would be,
is this too happy?
Is this too fluffy? Are we wasting our resources doing this?
Sonia or Noreen, have you ever pitched something that just got rejected because it wouldn't work? You know, this is a new show. So it's got the groundwork, it's really funny. There are a lot of women's issues, but not overwhelmingly. Is there a territory that's been staked that you feel you really need to explore?
I really don't think that there's any topics that we would shy away from as long as they are funny. Part of the reason that we gravitate towards women's issues is because Sam is a woman, and it's largely feminist staff.
Also because there's less coverage of those issues.
Right. One of the first segments that I did that I loved was Samantha Bee's Job Fair for Women, and it went like industry by industry, documenting allegations of terrible, terrible sexual harassment in every single industry. It was really dark, and
people
were groaning at the sound bites, like it was dark.
What was the one job category that elicited the biggest groans?
We interviewed some women who were on a cruise ship, and she was sexually harassed on her birthday, and she was like, well, at least he made me a birthday cake. I think there was some discussion of whether to cut that because she herself
made a joke about it, but it was nobody laughed.
Yeah, and I think a lot of our segments have some grown moments, but I think Sam really likes that.
Yeah, I think the sweet spot that we have is bring everyone way down and then have like a moment of catharsis with the job fair. I think it's so rare to hear people acknowledge sexual harassment in the workplace on TV at all. She just took it as a given that A, it happens to everyone, and B, that it's absolutely not okay. And just having someone just say that in no uncertain terms, the entire audience that night went wild over that line.
That last line where she said, I can just imagine a guy saying, well, what am I supposed to do? Not ask women out at work because it makes them uncomfortable? And just, yes, you were at work. And it made everyone go wild.
Yeah.
That was, I also went like internally wild.
Yeah.
So, but to go back to your question, mm-hmm. I don't think there's topics, but in journalism, you can present things with data, or you can lay out an analysis. But with this, you need more.
Yeah, I mean, also mm-hmm. it's like TV also has like lots of added elements to it that go beyond just like what makes a good news story in general. So there's a lot of things to think of. I think there are stories I've like kept pitching passive aggressively because I think they're really important. But for some reason, we just can't find an angle that would be good for us. Things don't really get rejected right now. I think we're too new. We're like really open to trying things out.
So you can keep on. You can keep on like repitching,
exactly.
Like mm-hmm. answering your own email mm-hmm. like 7 times.
Just circling back to this email. I don't know if you guys remember, but
you know what's interesting though, at least on our show, how Cord was saying, and it's true, like you want to make sure something has weight. Just being funny isn't enough. But a lot of times, when you find just that pure silly moment, if you can find a way to insert a pure silly moment that is utterly meaningless just for the laugh, but it fits into the more serious story, sometimes that's what puts the serious story over the line.
On The Daily Show, isn't it the puns that are in the segments
for
or things
example,
like that?
Yeah, right.
I can give an example. One of the last things that I wrote for The Daily Show is we were doing a Supreme Court piece, and I had Larry say, this is news from the highest court in the land. And no, I'm not talking about the daytime talk show, Rasta Court. And then we cut to one of the guys, and it was just, it was just a Rasta
very
party
random.
You know, smoking a huge joint. And he bangs the gavel and he goes, you're free to go, man. And then we went back to Larry. Like, it's so ridiculous. It was one of the things that I wrote that I was like, this is never going to make it through. And luckily, I couldn't believe that it ended up on air that night.
I'm noticing a theme to your jokes there. I think that we should take some questions.
The people asking questions aren't mic'd, so I'll provide subtitles. The first questioner observes that the news media seem to handle the lies of politicians reasonably well, but are stymied by out-and-out BS. He said comedy seems to handle BS better. So, how and why? Daniel Radosh speaks first.
I mean, I guess I need to understand the difference between lies and bullshit.
But a lot of people, especially politicians, they sort of mix up half-truth and then they make up stuff that's, you can't say that's not true.
Well, I think
that's I think I can answer that question if that's... I think the problem is with journalists, we have a tradition dating really not that far back in the history of journalism, of objectivity, which doesn't exist. And when you argue over a fact, you don't have to walk into that realm. But if you are going to take on the entire environment of a stream of bullshit, then you have to make a judgment, and then you open yourself up for criticism, something that people who write comedy are fine with, but can hurt a journalist, and that's why we have so much fake balance. One person saying one thing given equal time to another person whose position holds no weight at all, but just, it's actually misleading to offer a balanced presentation of two wildly unequal views, but that is something that still plagues the business, and that's why comedy does it better.
I would say that every night, what we tried to do at The Nightly Show was advocate. We chose a side, and we gave Larry an opinion, and Larry said his opinion on air.
You gave Larry an opinion?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes we did. That's just the nature of it. There's so many stories that we have to cover. But I would say that every day you're advocating for something. It's not, you don't go in there unbiased. You don't go in there saying, we have to be polite and understand, like, there's rules to journalism. And by virtue of what we do, we're allowed to call people assholes and say you're wrong. And we are allowed to say that. The New York Times, for the most part, can't say that kind of thing because that's goes against the decorum of the New York Times, which I think is ridiculous sometimes. But that's, hey, that's what it is.
Another questioner notes that a show that's not represented here, but is in his top four, is Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
I love that we can now say the top four. You know? That's great that there's so many of these shows.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like his format, maybe it's just because it's HBO, but his format is dramatic.
The questioner wonders if the format that Oliver chose, which is dramatically different, works to his advantage.
Daily Show and Nightly Show do 22 shows in 5 weeks. So if we had the luxury of time, I think that that is, I mean, I would kill for that. Besides the sort of roster of talent that they've amassed over there, I think that that is very helpful for what they're trying to do is the time.
I think they've
I was just going to ask these guys because they do a weekly show and
I don't think that we...
I think it's a little different when you have to have commercial breaks at certain times. We have 7 minutes to do a thing and it has to end on a note where everyone's going to clap so that we can go to a commercial break. We have some time to dig deep into things, but you really can't do anything longer than 8 minutes.
But I'll also say that I think John Oliver took their biggest disadvantage and turned it to their advantage. Mm-hmm. The disadvantage is they don't have the nightly news cycle because all of us will have chewed it up before they get to it. And I think if you watch the early shows, they didn't quite know what to do with that. And then they realized, oh, well, what we have that other people don't have is the time to expand on something that isn't in the daily news cycle. And they really created that niche, I think, out of necessity.
Plus, they can show penises and swear. That is always going to be funnier.
If we had this grand shift in how people watch news and people stopped watching the classic news programs and all started watching fake news, would you all consider that a grand victory?
No.
Did they stop reading news, too, or just watching it? As long as they're still reading it or listening to NPR, they can stop watching cable news, sure.
I think that people have. I mean, look at cable news ratings. I think that people have stopped watching cable news. I don't want the New York Times to go away in favor of The Daily Show or The Nightly Show or Samantha Bee. I will say that. I think that there are journalistic institutions that deserve to be there. On the other hand, there are journalistic institutions that are, like, ossified and terrible and deserve to go away.
And on that note.
Noreen, Sonia, Dan, Cord, thank you so much.
So much for this On the Media Podcast Extra. If you want more OTM, you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's often seriously funny. For a daily dose of OTM, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where we post all the stuff we're taking in. It's OTM at the Trough. Thanks for listening. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.